Shrink Wrap Radio number 369, a biopsychological model to guide psychotherapy with Robert Moss.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Bob Moss, and we'll be discussing his theory of cortical columns and the clinical biopsychological approach to therapy that he's developed. Robert A. Moss, Ph.D., ABN, ABPP, is a clinical psychologist who works with Bon Secours St. Francis Hospital in Greenville, South Carolina. While teaching neuropsychology in 1984, he developed a theory that the cortical column is the binary unit involved in all cortical processing and memory storage. Based on this theory, the clinical biopsychological approach to therapy was developed and continued to guide his work while in full-time private practice for over 20 years. As of 2006, the neuroscience field provided sufficient evidence to make the brain model publishable in a refereed journal, with a detailed description of its application to psychotherapy being published this year. One aspect of treatment, emotional restructuring, is a single-session approach to address influential relationship negative emotional memories. Bob is board certified in clinical psychology and neuropsychology and is a former associate professor in clinical psychology. He has authored 43 professional articles and has presented at a number of professional meetings. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Robert Moss, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm really happy to have you on the show. We are going to be talking about some neuroscience theories that you've developed, but I believe your background is that of a clinical psychologist. So when and how did you become so interested in neuroscience, and how did you get up to speed on it?
Well, I've always had an interest. That's the one thing. Even as an undergraduate, I actually had more interest in biopsychology than I did in clinical. But I made the decision to go into clinical, and I actually had a co-major in biopsychology when I was in graduate school. And I've always just had been drawn to understanding the brain. It's just one of those things that felt right to me.
Yeah. Now, I'm surprised they even had a biopsychology emphasis. Where was that?
University of Georgia.
Uh-huh. Well, they were probably ahead of their time.
Well, actually, they had the biopsych program. It was neuropsychology that was just, you know, coming online at that point in time. And so I had a neuropsych course while I was there, but again, there was no formal neuropsych program.
And what year was that?
1981 is when I finished.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess that's about the right time frame for all of this new sort of brain science information to be coming online. Now, I first came across your name and something you submitted to the online journal, The Neuropsychotherapist, and you made a reference to cortical columns, and I went, what? I'd never heard of cortical columns, probably to have you explain cortical columns at this point might be too early, so let's postpone that to some point in our discussion where it fits in naturally.
Oh, sure.
In fact, I believe your cortical columns hypothesis is part of your larger clinical biopsychological model. So take us through that model, if you will.
Well, actually, the model itself is based upon that brain model. It's called a dimensional systems model. It was published, the first paper, back in 2006. I actually developed this back in 1984 when I was teaching a neuropsychology course at the University of Mississippi. And when I first actually wrote up the paper and submitted it, it was very soundly rejected for being way too speculative and untestable. So it took 22 years for the first paper to actually be published when the field had actually progressed enough to provide enough supporting data.
Well, good for you. You get high marks for being very persistent and for vision, 22-year in the future vision.
Well, and of course, I was in practice for years, and I was using this as the guidance in terms of all the things I was working with in therapy with patients. And so the end result is that it's a well-developed theory over the years. The first clinical paper was published back in 2007 tied to negative emotional memories in the Journal of Psychotherapy Integration, talking about theoretically where these come from, but particularly talking, and we'll do that during the course of the program, I'm sure, talking about the emotional restructuring procedure that is designed to actually address, neutralize, if we can, past negative emotional memories tied to relationships. And then basically continued to publish several other papers clinically. We did an update with three graduate students at the end of last year on the basic brain model, adding in new dimensions, and we'll get into more of those things. But then the first very comprehensive theoretical paper going from the brain model to the clinical biopsychological applied model was just published about 2 months ago. And when I went through in great detail, step by step, of how it all translates, and as we'll talk today, talking about the fact of this whole concept of consciousness as people typically use it, and unconsciousness and so forth, actually explaining how these things can occur, and also the upcoming paper talking about this as it's related to personality aspects, interpersonal behavior patterns, if you will.
Yeah, great. Now, I read this paper that I guess is about to come out. You sent me a copy, and so that's really going to be the basis of our discussion here, although you can certainly go outside it. So you say all human behavior is motivated by a prime directive to maximize positive and minimize negative emotional experiences, and that almost seems too simple. And I seem to recall some debate about that in the literature. Am I correct that there's been some controversy around that idea?
Oh, sure. I mean, again, this dates back many, many years, obviously. But if you go into psychodynamic theory, pleasure principle concepts and so forth. And, of course, I came from a behavioral background myself. And, of course, we didn't want to talk about what was in the black box. But we talked about positive, negative reinforcement, punishment and so forth. And so the end result was, even though we did not want to infer what was going on internally, conceptually it's the same kind of thing. And I think most people would have a real hard time debating the fact, do you actually not experience positive emotions when you actually are increasing your behavior on the basis of positive reinforcement? Same kind of thing if you apply negative stimulus, punishment kinds of things, and it decreases behavior. I think few people would have, really difficulty accepting the fact that with negative emotionally being experienced, then you're going to try to avoid or escape those kinds of things. But you're correct, there has been controversy about these things.
Yeah, I seem to recall people bringing up the example of somebody deciding to sacrifice their life to save their child, for example, or their spouse or a good friend, and that there's no immediate positive reinforcement for that decision.
Correct. It's not immediate, but if you look at it, and this goes back to the whole thing we'll talk about today in relation to personality or interpersonal relationship behaviors, we actually see that, of course, like with anything else, that we're going to have a long history in terms of developing what turns on positive emotions for us tied to relationship, turns on negative emotions. And we develop certain rules many times, which will actually be more, we'll talk left hemisphere, verbal interpreter kinds of things. But in essence here, I have that rule that says that I need to protect my child. And so the end result is that the logic then overrides the immediate emotion and puts myself in harm's way as a result.
Okay, you just made reference to the hemispheres, and that's an important part of your theory, and you say that memory is stored differently and processed differently in the left and right hemispheres. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, the whole basis of the theory, and this goes back to the concept of the cortical column being the binary unit, is that all memory and processing in the cortex, this is where you're going to see any higher level memories being stored there. Right and left, we're going to see the same patterns in terms of how memories are actually formed and stored cortically. but based upon the processing style of each hemisphere, that determines what each one, the functions that will be controlled by each. But the bottom line comes down to it, the cortical hemispheres themselves interplay with all the subcortical areas in terms of creating emotions, physiological reactions like sympathetic nervous system activation and so forth. And so you see an interplay between the two, but the key difference in terms of what I'm talking about, and this is getting more and more press, I just saw something in the past week about this, is that memories are actually stored cortically and not in the hippocampus, not subcortically in areas, not in the body. And so, again, that's is very exact in terms of suggesting this is where they are.
Wow, I had not heard that latest development about them not being stored in the hippocampus, because it seems to me that I've been reading, you know, a lot about them, about the role of the hippocampus.
Yeah, there was just a tweet that came out in the past couple of weeks here, and it's actually on there right now in terms of, I think it's Science Digest out of Max Planck Institute. It's the second paper. It was a press release that came out, and basically the study is talking about it, particularly in the motor cortex, suggesting here, and that's the actual, the line on it is that memories are being stored cortically, not in the hippocampus.
Hmm.
And so, again, that's right now in this past week. In fact, I just commented on it about 2 days ago on one of the posts that were out there.
So you refer to the different quality associated with each hemisphere. Take us through that, if you will.
I guess the easiest way for me to kind of put it to you is the left side is going to process information in a very detailed analytical manner, therefore being slower in processing speed, the right side processing much faster. So therefore, the memories that are stored there and the processing that occurs is not going to be as detailed. It's going to be much more global. If you think about developing our native spoken language, people are going to acknowledge that for most people that is, you know, a function of the left hemisphere. It's very detailed, very analytical. It takes a great deal of memory storage to do. And so, therefore, we have our native verbal language. For me, being reared in this country, English basically will be my native verbal language, and it will be with me for the remainder of my life, barring damage to the left hemisphere. However, very importantly, in the right hemisphere, since it processes much faster and the memories are less detailed, the memories are being formed earlier in development compared to the verbal memories. And so our nonverbal emotional memories based upon like intonations in the voice, based upon touch, based upon, visual facial expression kinds of things and so forth, then we're going to be forming those memories very early on during the first year of life. And theoretically, this is what I've suggested is we now form our native emotional language based upon what feels positive to us, feels negative to us, based upon the memories that are stored. And we also then learn our behavioral expression in terms of my facial expressions, my body position, my body gestures, those kinds of things. And those are right hemisphere. So our native verbal language being left hemisphere, native emotional language being right hemisphere.
Now, the part about the right hemisphere being faster was new to me, and I'm wondering if that plays a role in our emotional reactivity. We move into emotion. if you're married, you know, emotions can flare up really quickly.
Of course they can. And actually, we're just talking about the right and the left here. There's actually within each hemisphere, you're going to have different processing modes as well. We won't go into that. But basically, in terms of the right side, you're exactly right. It processes information much faster, so therefore it is actually best designed to ensure survival, for example, if there's an outside danger. So in essence here, it's designed to be our fast, complex behavior reaction compared to the left. And so basically when you start to look at it, yeah, the understanding that it processes faster has been around for quite some time, and also global processing has been a concept that's been around for many years as well. But we do basically use that right hemisphere, and like you say, if you kind of lose your cool with somebody, the right frontal area that is involved with the expression is what assumes control and actually can suppress my ability to verbally talk, think. And that's the reason if you talk to somebody and try to reason with them who are angry, they tend to just get angrier. The right hemisphere maintains more control.
Yeah. Now, I was surprised, though, to hear that the hemisphere would be involved, because I thought that all of that sort of extreme fight or flight stuff was subcortical.
The answer is the physiological reactions are subcortical. The easiest way I can give that to you is most people are familiar with hearing the term amygdala. And basically, I have a standing joke, and I taught the students this, is that for clinicians, he who invokes the word amygdala first wins, because everybody gets intimidated right away when you hear that term, like somebody knows more than I do. The reality is you have a fast track to the amygdala that Ledoux has done all kinds of work with, that goes from the thalamus to the amygdala. But then you have also going to the cortex, particularly in this case, we're talking about the parietal cortex, that basically when you go to there, it's going to project from the cortex right back down to the same location in the amygdala. And so therefore, you have a cortical input to it as well as a subcortical. Well, the memories then, as I'm theorizing here, are stored cortically. So whenever, say, for example, you have a negative emotional memory, whether it's traumatic or not, activated, that is occurring in the right parietal area or the right hemisphere, which in turn can activate the amygdala, which in turn then activates all the physiological responses through the lateral hypothalamus going to the sympathetic system and to the periventricular hypothalamus, which actually activates the HPA axis and so forth. So again, I don't want to get too detailed where we're talking about this, but the bottom line is the cortical memories then are actually what activates the physiological things subcortically in that situation if it's based upon memory.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of the two hemispheres, I had a chance to interview Ian McGilchrist about his book, The Master and His Emissary. Are you familiar with that work?
Actually, I'm not.
Oh, you'll definitely want to take a look at it, because he develops a whole cultural view based on how the two hemispheres interact and their role, and kind of to really oversimplify his position, his contention is that culturally we're too left hemispheric dominant, and that we need more of the right hemisphere. So it's a long book, and it's a wide ranging, but you'll definitely want to take a look at that. Yeah, I was going to ask you about points of agreement and disagreement, but we'll have to table that for now.
Well, I will go on one point that you brought up there, and that is that based upon the theory with which I'm working, is that the left ventral frontal area, called area in and around Broca's area and the frontal lobe on the left side there, is what I've suggested here, and is consistent with some other people, but I refer to it as the verbal interpreter. This is where we interpret things verbally when we talk to ourselves in our head. This is part of the thesis in terms of the publication that was there earlier this year. I explained it in more detail. But more or less, then, whenever we talk to ourselves in our head, it's in that left frontal area. And the bottom line is, if that area is not connected to the area that's processing, for example, the right posterior, right backside of the brain, it's not directly connected in any shape, form, or fashion. So therefore, if I have emotional memories being activated in the right backside of the brain, the left front side is completely unaware of exactly what's causing those memories and the feelings to be activated. And so this is your unconsciousness, if you will, that we, as we typically use the term, we think about consciousness being that verbal interpreter, which is a very restricted small area in the left frontal area. And so the bottom line is it tries to explain everything, even though it may not be aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, earlier you mentioned your behavioral background, your early training there, but you also used the word psychodynamic at one point. So it seems like you're familiar with that viewpoint as well.
Correct.
Do you sort of integrate both in your work?
Well, the way that I kind of put it is that if you look at humanistic experiential procedures, you look at psychodynamic theory, you look at cognitive behavioral kinds of things, To a large extent, they're each describing things quite accurately based upon what they perceive and what they see, none of which come from a brain model. If you kind of think about it, three blind men and the elephant, each touching the one touching the trunk, one touching the body, one touching the tail, they all basically describe accurately what is going on. But if you then have a model and you get a complete picture of what's going on, you see exactly why they're saying what they're saying. And so they all are right, but only partly so because of what areas or what specific things they're describing. So a comprehensive brain model should be able to incorporate and explain the observations from all the major areas.
Yeah, good point. Now, from your study of the brain, you get to what seems to me like a personality theory in which you posit two types of relationship patterns, and you describe those two patterns as givers and takers. Now, on the face of it, this seems a bit too simple to boil the world down to just two kinds of people, givers and takers. So you better take us through your reasoning here.
Okay. Well, let's take it from two angles. One is how it could actually happen. Just in terms of a lot of people are familiar with the big five theory, five factors theory in terms of personality. And actually, when you start looking, they thought originally these five factors were all independent. But later it was found that it boils down to they actually have what they refer to as two meta traits. So it comes down to two major factors that kind of incorporate the five.
What were the five? Because not everybody that's listening is going to be familiar with that.
Extroversion, openness, intellect kind of thing, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and neuroticism. So those are the five factors. Okay. Good. And the two meta traits they've described are actually plasticity and stability. And the stability things corresponds with what they describe very much with the giver type that I'll be just talking about. And the plasticity actually corresponds very nicely in terms of what's described there with the taker type. And I refer to these as type T and type G because giver taker many times, again, when I'm talking with patients, as we're talking with other people, I use giver taker. Just flows very easily. People have the concepts quickly. But unfortunately, when they actually say it, they're actually many times describing the opposite. Many times, givers are those that are seen by society as being takers, and takers many times are perceived as being givers based upon the motivational stuff that I describe.
Well, say a little bit more about that. Maybe you could give an example of what you've just said.
Okay, an example would be the fact of takers, in terms of the basic rule that I talk about with takers, if you kind of boil it all down to the simplest is, I win, I get my way. And so basically takers are in relationships are trying to take power, control, attention, or things for themselves. Well, if indeed I can do a high visibility kind of good act for someone, then I'm actually giving behaviorally, but it's designed to get more power, control, attention for myself. Mm-hmm. So payoff for the good act that I'm doing. Givers, on the other hand, feel many times very uncomfortable being in the limelight. They're the ones who basically many times, the rule they're going to play by is, I want to be the good guy. Can I stand and feel like the bad guy no matter what? So therefore, they feel guilty so easily. They more or less try to avoid feeling like the bad person. So in essence, with their behavior then, they're going to be giving power, control, attention, or things in relationships, much more so. So for a giver, the major positive thing is, if I can do something for you that was my idea, and I feel like I did a very good job at it, and you appreciate it, that's a major positive feeling. Now, basically, with givers, however, they give the way they know to based on their own learning history. So if you have a giver you're married to, for example, who came from a background where there was no hugging, kissing, that you kind of showed that kind of thing by doing for others behaviorally or being a good provider, then if you're in that relationship with that person, many times you may be wanting that physical affection and you just can't get it. And you get frustrated, you try to bring it up to them, you tell them that, and then more or less you make them feel like the bad guy for not doing it. So they'll give you that little hug, but it just doesn't feel quite like you're looking for. So they're only doing it to avoid being the bad guy there. I'm giving you what you're asking for, but it's not the way I want to give. And so in essence, then many times, the giver begins to avoid those kinds of situations. And so therefore, they kind of get labeled as, well, you're just looking out for yourself. You're not thinking about anybody else here. So again, it's an interesting patterns when we start talking about these things.
Yeah, that's a great example. Now, how does one assess whether another or even oneself is a giver or a taker?
Well, in therapy, I kind of emphasize to the clients, they will always ask me, you know, do you think I'm a giver or a taker? And I say, you'll figure it out along the way. More important for you to be focusing on understanding the behavior of those with whom you have a close relationship. Because if I can now understand why you are doing what you're doing, it basically gets me out of the concept of what is it about me causing you to be this way. I start asking the question, what is it about you that causes you to be this way? And if I can understand why you're doing what you're doing, and I can then take that one step further, and I can then modify my behavior, knowing how you operate, then I can actually improve the relationship and our interactions over time. Because I'm now responding to you, understanding how you are. And so in essence, if I focus it outside of myself, and this goes back to the whole thing in terms of relationship negative emotional memories. The negative emotional memories we form that have the most detrimental effect on us are those where we felt a lack of control during the time, or we felt somehow personally inadequate or personally responsible. And again, if we have time, we'll talk about that. And that's one of the aspects in terms of treating past negative emotional relationship memories that we have to take into consideration. But if you kind of think about it, if I am now basically thinking, what is it about you causing you to be this way? I'm now externalizing this. And so therefore, I'm not going to feel out of control and I'm not going to feel like it's me. So it actually insulates me from forming new negative emotional memories that would be further detrimental down the road on me as well.
Okay, so that's kind of how it ties back into our earlier discussion about the brain, the hemispheres, and the storage of emotional memories, right?
Right.
So at a later point in your theory, you tie all this into family systems. How so?
Well, obviously, we're talking, when I started talking about forming emotional memories, let's take, for example, from the very earliest memories I'm going to start to store. I'm an infant, I am wet, I start to cry. If I have a parent who comes and responds to me, picks me up, changes my diaper, what I'm learning is, and particularly talking to me because they're holding me in a soothing tone of voice, that kind of thing, I'm learning the world is a very safe place, but I'm forming the emotional memories in the right hemisphere tied to that. What I am learning is that, hey, I can be held, I can be cuddled, those kinds of things. It feels very positive to me. These are the attachment memories that form early on. And behaviorally, then, I'm also learning that the world will respond to me based upon me giving the world information. I'm crying, you respond to me, you give me a smile, I smile back, you smile even more at me, I'm interacting. I'm forming these emotional memories in the right hemisphere during this time that's determining what's feeling positive. The flip side would be is if indeed you respond to me when I'm crying by either ignoring me or getting angry, raising your voice, screaming at me, shaking me, whatever kinds of things. Well, now I'm learning the world's a pretty dangerous place if you're doing those things, or if I get ignored, that the world doesn't really care. So now I'm starting early on to form the lack of emotional attachment memories. And so therefore, later in my life, I would not have formed the basic memories because there's critical periods in the brain for humans as well as for other mammals and so forth. And if we don't develop these things early on, we're not going to later develop. You got to have the basic building blocks to build upon that then to actually get more complex memories and so forth. And you don't have the basic building blocks emotionally, then at age 5, 6, 7 or whatever, I might get put into a loving family. But what the family finds is that I'm not responding to their touches. I'm not responding to their niceness in many respects and spontaneously showing my own reactions. So the idea is that we start forming these emotional memories very early on and we continue doing so. And if you think about it, within our family system, the family system, parents as well as the other siblings that are there, determine, if you will, what's going to get rewarded, what's not going to get rewarded in relationship behaviors. And so I start to develop my own idiosyncratic kind of patterns. If my brother or sister or whatever might be whiny, complaining, well, I can't maximize getting the most positive and least negative kinds of things in that family environment doing the same thing. So I might develop then into a pattern of being much more achievement-oriented, much more intellectual or, you know, doing these, you know, doing deed kinds of things and accomplishing things. So our family environment determines basically what's going to be rewarded, what's not going to be rewarded, And those are the emotional memories that in our later relationships that will be activated to determine what feels positive and negative to us. And we learn to behaviorally interact in those kinds of patterns. So it's a developmental pattern from the time of being born right up into typically your late childhood, early adolescent years, and so forth, that I would say is going to basically determine then what pattern you're going to find throughout your relationships in your life that's going to activate the positive, deactivate the negative, and so forth.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you integrate this the brain science information with the behavioral, with the psychodynamic, and particularly with attachment theory, because attachment theory really seems to be in ascendance right now, with a lot of evidence supporting it, and basically originally, I think, coming from more of a psychodynamic point of view, and now people are relating that to what's going on in the brain. So it seems like you've really got a very integrative theory going.
Well, I would think so. And again, if indeed what I'm describing is accurate tied to the processing within the brain itself, then it should be able to explain all these different aspects of things and pull it all together. A truly integrative psychotherapy approach in terms of not only understanding why things develop, but also then based upon that targeting the areas and treatment that you're choosing to pursue.
Well, let's talk about psychotherapy some more. You say the goal of therapy is not to change one from a taker into a giver or vice versa. In fact, you say that would be maladaptive. How so?
Well, if you think about it, both patterns can be maladaptive. I've already touched upon that. The adaptive pattern would be an individual who can give and take equally well in the relationship, but not forcing the world to give to them or take from them. In other words, they would be very, very good. And I'm not talking about intellectual kinds of things. They'd be fully aware of all their emotional functioning and things. But in essence here, it'd be the ability to give and take equally well in a relationship. A maladaptive example in terms of a giver type that I've used, let's say we have an individual who's been hardworking, does manual labor kinds of things, always achieved well, been respected by people because of the work ethic and so forth. This individual now gets injured and has a chronic pain problem. Well, now they're presented with a situation where the very things they used to do to actually feel positive about themselves, getting busy, being active, are the very things that now create negative emotions because of the increase in pain that they have. So now basically they cannot continue in that pattern, but obviously they want to be self-sufficient. Well, this kind of individual may decide, I don't want to be on disability. I don't want to, you know, apply for this kind of thing. Even though they may be having to sell off all the stuff that they have and so forth, they may be seeing relationships deteriorate because of these things. But because they have the belief that I need to be self-sufficient, I don't want to be the bad guy in anybody's eyes here, then they may actually put off applying and actually end up bankrupt, losing things and so forth before they make the step to do it. And if you're aware of the disability system, the first time you apply and so forth, then many times there's going to be a denial. And now it's almost like they've been told, you are the bad guy. You really are not disabled. And now that actually makes them feel even worse and more guilty. And they may actually discontinue the process. So this is just an example of how a giver pattern many times prevents the person from comfortably being able to accept from the world around them that the kind, if you give them a cake, they want to give you back two pies. Okay? It's just easier not to feel obligated to someone.
Yeah.
Takers, on the other hand, and we hear these things all the time, you have an individual in a very abusive relationship. The individual, this taker, is very, if you will, under-socialized, very domineering and so forth. And they more or less basically are very verbally abusive and things like that. The other spouse basically starts, if they're, you know, quiet, they don't want to rock the boat, they don't draw limits with them, and we begin to see a city escalation in terms of the negative, the violence kinds of things. Then the spouse leaves once because I can't take it anymore, but then the other, the taker spouse many times comes back in there, they can apologize, they can sound like, you know, things are going to change, everything will be hunky-dory and so forth, and this whole pattern sometimes can culminate to the point where the taker feels that they cannot take any more power and control based upon how far they've gone. And it may actually go into that fit of rage where they actually take the person's life.
Mm-hmm.
You can see these extreme patterns, and that's the reason if somebody's in a relationship, for example, with a taker who's domineering and under-socialized like that, this is actual danger kinds of things. You don't sit there and basically, if you're going to more or less draw limits, you have to start drawing limits with them and stick to your guns. And sometimes it necessitates actually leaving a relationship. But again, you're talking about actual kinds of patterns then with takers. And if you can see this at global levels, and a great example in terms of an unrestrained taker would be Adolf Hitler. Basically, you know, he's got all the control in his country. He goes into the next, he takes the next one and so forth. It's never enough. But again, then at the very end, that type of individual, if I see that I'm losing and I have access to things like nuclear weapons, they would actually destroy the world and themselves in the process. So again, when you start taking this to its extremes, then you can start seeing how these patterns tend to fit with the behavior that we see. Fortunately, society and people tend to constrain one another so that those patterns don't get so extreme.
Yeah, you brought up Adolf Hitler. I was tempted earlier to ask you for some political examples of these different types.
Well, let's do it historically.
Yeah.
A standing theory that givers really cannot survive very long in the current political climate, and the reason being is everything is under mass media. Everybody watches everything. Takers are those, the plasticity concept is, they can talk a great game. They can land on their feet every time. You catch them doing something, they can be so apologetic and things, but they can shift so quickly, and that's their adaptive functioning when you start looking at it, because they're going to win. And you get into a disagreement, say, with a taker, they can be, at home, they can be yelling at you, screaming at you, things like that. Let the phone ring, they can pick it up and sound sweet when they pick up the phone. Giver, on the other hand, I mean, once they get going with something, everybody's going to see the same thing across the board. I mean, they don't just shift like that just because somebody else walks into the room. They're still angry.
Mm-hmm.
Givers, they're rule governed typically because they develop rules to say what's good, bad guy, what's bad guy. And so in the current political climate, they would have a very difficult time sticking to their rules because they're going to, if you will, disenfranchise certain groups, and they're not going to change what they're saying because they're following the rules that they believe are accurate.
Okay, coming back to psychotherapy, so the goal of therapy, from your point of view, is what?
Actually, it depends upon what the person presents with and what the goal of the client or the patient is that actually determine those kinds of things. And that's the reason, obviously, we have to be sensitive to whatever the person's looking for. But then it becomes one of how do I help that person achieve what their goal is? The vast majority of people I have seen in therapy are wanting to turn off negative emotional states. That's the reason that they typically are presenting. And so, therefore, it's a matter of how do we go about doing that and then allowing you to have the healthiest, best quality of life that you possibly can. So it's not really a preconceived notion. The client is the one that determines exactly what we're shooting for.
I'm wondering if you're familiar with the work of Bruce Ecker. You mentioned Joseph Ledoux earlier, and Ecker's writing seems that there's some similarities between the two of you.
I have read some of the things through the neuropsychotherapist. This is where I've been involved with that with them, and this is the International Journal of Neuropsychotherapy is where the paper is about to be published. And so, therefore, since he was associated with them as well in terms of for the experts and so panel of experts, then I've kind of familiarized myself, since I'm there as well, with some of the thinking and some of the articles that they have written, not in great detail, but I have reviewed the things I had access to.
Yeah, you'll definitely want to look at his book, Unlocking the Emotional Brain, and I think you'll find that you two are on the same page in some ways, because you emphasized earlier, I think, the importance of, you didn't use the word reprogramming, but his work, drawing on, again on Joseph Ledoux, suggests that there's a critical period during which an intensely experienced negative emotional memory, that there's a brief period in which the gate is open, so to speak, to implant a different orientation towards that memory.
Well, and I will go one step further, and this has to do with the fact that the frontal lobes control all actions that we do, both right and left. We are accustomed to the fact that the left side of doing this, what they refer to as memory reconsolidation all the time.
Yes.
An example would be is that we basically have information that we've been presented before, but we now incorporate new verbal information that presents a different, the whole schema change, or basically I have a new model being presented to me that makes sense and better explains something than the old model did. Well, now all of a sudden, because I'm using the frontal lobe, the verbal interpreter, as I mentioned earlier, basically now I can take these new concepts and I can start to work with those new concepts. People don't recognize the fact, well, I have just reconsolidated all these kinds of things in the left side of my brain. So now I'm actually thinking differently about this thing because I was presented this new information. I began to work with it in terms of the action, the frontal lobes actively controlling or working with us kinds of thing. And so therefore we have seen throughout our entire history as we're coming up through school, learning new things, learning new concepts, we do this. Well, people are all of a sudden surprised to say, well, you can do the same thing in the right hemisphere. But the same basic design is there that allows it in the left. You just have to access it in a different way in the right. And the way that's typically done is the use of things such as experiential techniques, things such as visual imagery and so forth. And so therefore you can actually then use that to actually add a new ending to a memory that's an old memory. And so now all of a sudden I begin to find when that memory gets reactivated, it now reactivates new frontal columns, frontal memory kinds of things, and I feel differently as a result. It's not that I'm verbally thinking differently as much as I'm feeling differently in reaction. And so therefore, that's memory reconsolidation based on my theory, but we've been doing it and observing it and accepting it in the left hemisphere for as long as we can remember.
Yeah, well, the way you describe it in the left hemisphere, you know, sounds like logic can prevail, but what we know from years and years of psychotherapy is that logical arguments don't seem to prevail in many situations.
Exactly. And the reason is you actually are addressing the left frontal area, trying to reconsolidate, if you will, the memories in the right hemisphere. The left frontal area that we're talking about, the verbal interpreter, in terms of the Broca's area and so forth, it actually interconnects back to the right hemisphere in the same frontal region. It does not have any effect in terms of or any connections to the right posterior cortex, where we talk about these non-verbal emotional memories being reactivated, and those actually activate then in the right frontal the typical behavior pattern that I've usually shown in reaction to those memories being reactivated. And so therefore, I continue to show the same patterns. Well, if you just logically present to the left side, this is not reasonable. Well, you gave the left side a great explanation, but the problem is they didn't change anything on the right side. The right frontal columns were not being addressed, or the right frontal memories, to bring on new memories.
Mm-hmm.
The reason experiential techniques, you're actually engaged in something. As a quick note, if you look at all the things, whether they're cathartic or not, depending on which theory you want to use, but experiential techniques, eye movement desensitization, reprocessing kinds of things included, if you look at the cases that are described that are actually being effectively treated, they go through a very distinct pattern. The first thing is the person will begin to have some high anxiety. You're accessing those negative emotional memories, which then activates, if you will, the physiological, psychological things tied to that. The next step, though, is if you engage the anger system, this is what you're talking about. Anger is an expressive emotion. Anger involves the right frontal area. If you engage that effectively, the person now feels in control. If you'll go back to what I talked about earlier, the negative emotional memories that affect us, we feel out of control. I now feel in control. And so now when I feel that kind of thing, that gives me an expression to it. For the first time, I feel like I win. The next step, though, in that process that you kind of see is the person now starts to feel some sadness. It's almost like a self-nurturing. I can kind of see a different perspective. And the highest level that a person can reach is actually attaining forgiveness of the individual, recognizing that they don't know what they were capable of doing based on where they came from. So if this is actually what occurs, then you'll see a lot of Greenberg stuff and so forth. In the Handbook of Emotion, he talks about these same kind of patterns and so forth. But you'll see consistently in the descriptions, this is what I see written. Well, the emotional restructuring procedure that I've described back in my 2007 paper, I've been working with in a treatment manual for many, many years since the early 90s. Basically, we can program that in a single session. If we can actually take the person through using giving them verbal information, then we actually take them through the experiential techniques, we use the visual imagery kinds of things, we can use them many times, find that we can neutralize in a single session many of these negative emotional memories that were there.
Yeah.
So differently in response to that. And so that's one of the things, the hallmark of what I've talked about is if this is what's going on, we can actually pick out what are the problem relationships that existed, mother, father, peers, siblings, teachers, bosses, past relationship. You go through and figure out which one of these memories were detrimental based on that loss of control, feeling personally inadequate, and you can programmatically go through step by step addressing each in the same emotional restructuring fashion. So within five sessions, you could actually theoretically address five separate past issues as opposed to trying to evolve it slowly and perhaps maybe addressing that fifth, sixth treatment session, one issue. So again, I think we can accelerate it based on this.
Yeah, and that certainly ties in with the number of people that I've interviewed. It ties in with what Bruce Ecker is saying. The EMDR people, emotional freedom technique people. Another thing that's very, very popular, and you made some reference to consciousness and unconsciousness, and right now it seems like a lot of people are talking about mindfulness, and I'm wondering how that might interface with your theory.
Well, actually, I addressed that also in the paper earlier this year where I talk about these things. Mindfulness techniques are non-judgmental experiencing in the moment kind of thing. If you kind of think about it, if you're non-judgmental, you're bringing the verbal interpreter offline. You're basically giving the interpreter a new rule, don't judge. So therefore, if I don't judge, then I'm going to decrease the interhemispheric conflict, if you will. I haven't mentioned the fact that the frontal lobes have the capability through probably the basal ganglia, as I mentioned in my paper, of inhibiting the other side. A good example that I've used before is that whenever you see basically the test anxiety or test phobic individuals, they form negative emotional memories tied to taking tests. The right hemisphere is designed to assume control if there's any kind of danger because it's the one that can best allow us to fight or to run. Well, if I now basically go into the testing situation, even though in the left hemisphere, I logically know all the information. When I go in, actually, the right hemisphere gets activated, and the right frontal area has an ability then to deactivate some of the activity in the left, so therefore my verbal thinking goes offline. So my mind goes blank. Well, it's gearing up as if there's an outside danger, and that's the reason it's kind of like, well, the right front side can inhibit the left. I leave the testing situation, deactivates the negative emotional memories in the right hemisphere tied to testing situations, and all of a sudden I finally have all that verbal information available once again. Well, the frontal lobes can inhibit one another. There's depression cases, you kind of see that where they talk about the right hemisphere being relatively higher in activity compared to the left, but both actually being lower in activity on EEGs and so forth. So again, we start looking at the fact of one side inhibiting the other. Well, in mindfulness kinds of things, if you take the left hemisphere offline in terms of it judging anything that's going on with the right side, then you're decreasing that conflict between the hemispheres. A person's going to have more feelings of peace. They more or less, they're going to be more, if you will, focusing. Many times you give them a focus point such as, focus on the sensations of breathing. And so now I have another focal point which further takes the verbal interpreter offline. And so the person then can more or less just experience in the now what's going on non-judgmentally, and they find that it's a very peaceful, refreshing, disengaging kind of aspect. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. You've covered a lot of ground. We probably should wrap it up here. Do you have any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I guess the major thing is that indeed this giver-taker concept has a pop psychology feel, even though there's a pretty good brain model behind it, and you can't just behaviorally kind of take it. But this is one aspect also of the emotional restructuring process is explaining why the people you had the problems with did the things the way they did them. So it's actually the giver-taker stuff incorporated into the emotional restructuring process as well. And in the article that is about to come out, actually by the time you have the program here, it'll be out, in the International Journal of Neuropsychotherapy, at the end of that I actually have information in terms of how do you actually most effectively deal with people. I've obviously written books, my website, emotionalrestructuring.com, both for lay individuals. I have a professional treatment manual as well. So I'll give myself a little plug in terms of the things that are as well, if you don't mind. some training, hopefully very soon. I've already got things arranged, both webinar and some other professional training, education kinds of things for professionals as well. And so we'll try to have a spot for people to sign up. There's probably about 3 months down the road before we have that online.
Well, excellent. We do have a lot of psychotherapists and psychotherapists in training who listen. So I'm sure they'll be very interested to follow up on that. Dr. Robert Moss, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, Dr. Bob Moss certainly covered a lot of ground in this interview. I hope you were able to keep up. In fact, this might be one of those episodes that you'll want to listen to more than once in order to wrap your mind around all of the content that he covered. Alternatively, or in addition, you might subscribe to the online journal, The Neuropsychotherapist. You'll find a link to that journal in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. Clicking on that link will take you to neuropsychotherapist.com. Some of the content on that site is free, and other parts require a paid subscription, which starts at $40 a year, but it's well worth it. You'll find that the content on this site is extremely rich. I'm happy to report that I'm on the advisory board and that we have a close working relationship. In fact, you'll discover postings there by some of my past guests, as well as articles by them or about them, as well as some of the transcripts from our site. The founder and editor-in-chief, Matthew Dolitz, is very demanding in terms of the production values and is producing content that is both deep and beautiful and on the cutting edge. So I believe that the article which Dr. Bob Moss and I were discussing in this episode will appear in the Neuropsychotherapist Journal quite soon. I must say that Dr. Moss's theory is quite comprehensive and, as you heard, seems to incorporate everything from brain science to attachment theory to behavioral theory to psychodynamic theory to memory reconsolidation to mindfulness and more. He's been working on this theory for at least 20 years, and his credentials are quite solid. You heard me read a bunch of letters after his name in the introduction, and a couple of those point to the fact that he is board certified. Board certification is a fairly arduous process beyond the PhD, which requires demonstrated competence and achievement in the field. As you heard, Dr. Moss is in the process of setting up trainings for psychotherapists interested in his approach. You can find out more about his work on his website at emotionalrestructuring.com.
My name is Grant Strine, and I practice clinical psychology in Havertown, Pennsylvania. After months of listening to Dr. Dave's spectacular interviews and noticing their positive effects in my personal and professional lives, I felt moved to offer a small token of monetary support. Not only did this extinguish any lingering guilt about not supporting, it boosted my mood for days. And I was so happy and pleasantly surprised to get a kind and thoughtful return email from Dr. Dave himself. Now I feel a profound satisfaction for being part of the Shrink Wrap Radio community.
Thanks, psychotherapist Grant Strine, for that message. You know, something I've forgotten to mention in a long time is that I do have CDs of the first 75 shows available for sale. I stopped mentioning it some time back because there never seemed to be a very large demand for them. But in certain circumstances, they can be a real time saver. I have them on three CDs. Each CD has 25 MP3 files on it and is available for $25. That's only $1 per episode and can be a real time saver over downloading them individually, especially if you have a really modern CD player, such as I do in my new Toyota Camry. The CD player in my previous car, a 2001 Honda Prelude, couldn't play MP3 files. The players in newer cars can, and of course they will definitely play on your computer. This comes to mind because of an email I recently received from listener Kathy O'Connor asking if shows were available in this format. Happily, she eagerly ordered all three discs, and so can you if you just drop me an email letting me know of your interest. If you're out of the country, I might need to add the cost of shipping to the price, but amortized over 75 episodes, it wouldn't add that much. An added bonus to catching up on these older shows is that you get to see how this podcast has evolved over time. You get to hear my very first efforts, the different musical formats I experimented with, some personal storytelling that I really enjoyed doing, my struggles with sound quality and equipment, and so on. And I must say that the content of those early episodes continues to be as relevant today as it was then. I think I also have a couple of DVDs of talks I've given that I used to advertise on the site. I'll have to see if I can dig up that information and repost it. Somehow it got lost off the store tab on our site. I guess it wasn't getting enough action, and so I let go of it. But hey, even if it appeals only to one or two people, it's worth it. Now, speaking of things getting lost, if you signed up on our site to receive our newsletter within the past 2 or 3 weeks, you might want to do so again. I recently upgraded our site and didn't realize that the component that collects those email addresses got wiped out. I've restored that functionality, and you might want to sign up again so that you'll be in our database. I'm happy to report that thanks to some diligent volunteers, we have 2 new transcripts on the site. First is one from way back that was very challenging and thought-provoking, and it's number 208, Pre- and Perinatal Psychology with Dr. William Emerson, and that's thanks to Fiona Bales. Also, we have number 366, a very recent one, The Dream and Its Amplification with Jungian analyst Nancy Ferlotti, and that's thanks to champion transcriptionist Gloria Ullman. You know, in addition to the education and entertainment you get from Shrinkwrap Radio, I sometimes need to remind myself that some percentage of listeners out there are looking for something more. I don't dispense therapeutic advice on the show or in my emails, yet people do write me about their psychological and spiritual wounds, and they often write to let me know how much comfort they find in these podcasts. So I guess even though I don't dispense advice per se, I do inspire hope. Hopefully that's what I dispense. And I want to let all of who are struggling with wounded parts that part of the message that emerges from all these interviews is that there is something out there, some approach or some personality that may well be matched to your condition. So don't give up. Don't give up on yourself or the helping enterprise. There is hope, and that in itself, I believe, can initiate the healing/growing process.
Hi, this is Dr. Amadeo, marriage and family therapist, international speaker, and author of Dancing with Fire, A Mindful Way to Loving Relationships, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, Dr. John Amadeo will be my next guest, and more about that in a bit. First, let's dip into some recent emails from our Shrinkwrap Radio listener community. You recall my mention of Kathy, who purchased the set of 3 CDs? Well, I should mention that she is also the wife of psychiatrist Michael O'Connor, both a Shrinkwrap Radio listener and an upcoming guest. And here's an email I received from Kathy. Hi, Dave. Interestingly, I did my undergraduate degree in psychology at the University of Toronto years ago with research in the Department of Animal Behavior and Learning. That was the argument at the time. I recall watching Burmese jungle fowl dust bathing under a variety of conditions and realizing that a researcher could achieve any result that they desired by altering the conditions sufficiently, parentheses, and ignoring observations/results that they were not measuring, close paren, exclamation point. My master's degree was in speech language pathology. I have given up my career to be at home with our children. I find listening to your podcast quite engaging as I find myself doing laundry and dishes or prepping food. My absolute favorite was a Jungian interpretation of fairy tales. I took Mike to a native sweat lodge this year and look forward to continuing my lifelong learning process, even though it's outside academia. Thank you for providing windows into so many different approaches to psychology and our minds. Mike and I enjoy discussing your podcast rather than watching anything on TV. Regards, Kathy. Well, I love that last line, Kathy. I've heard a lot of different ways that people listen to these shows while gardening, while running, while working on their computer, etc. But using them as a substitute for evening TV, hey, that's a new one and a great one. You and Mike are great role models for the rest of us. This next one is from David in Sweden, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've been a listener since 2007, and I really appreciate that you've had the strength to continue your podcast all these years, parentheses, and hopefully you will continue for some time to come, close paren. Shrink Wrap is still one of the best podcasts on the planet." Hey, I'm glad you think so. He goes on to say, "I would like to make a suggestion for a future interview. As a struggling internet porn addict, I can say for sure that Gary Wilson is onto something in this pretty much uncharted territory and the growing community of young men with desensitized brains, psychological symptoms, and erectile problems. No morals or religious perspectives going on here, just science. I would love to hear/see what would happen if you did an interview with him. And I think it would help a lot of persons in the same situation as me. All the best." And as I say, that's from David in Sweden. Well, he wrote a follow-up in response to my reply, and I'd like to share that with you as well. He says, "Hi, David. Thank you for your quick reply. I understand that you by now have a very long list of possible guests, and I will leave it up to you to decide which guests are the most interesting for your audience. Still, I hope you will have a little spare time over in your busy day to look through some of Gary's presentations. As a young man with a bachelor in psychology and with a lifestyle that consists of eating healthy foods, exercising on a regular basis, getting enough sleep, meditating daily, practicing stress management, having close, warm relationships, doing meaningful work, in other words, doing the right stuff, I have been confused by the symptoms that have appeared in the last 5 years, feeling constantly tired, brain fog, anxiety, concentration problems, things appear less enjoyable than before, restlessness, procrastination, etc. It had never occurred to me that these symptoms could be related to my escalating use of internet erotica until I saw Gary's videos about addiction-related brain changes, such as desensitization, parens, a decline in dopamine receptors, i.e. a numbered pleasure response, etc., and finding out about the global community of men experiencing the same puzzling symptoms for no or unclear reasons. This was completely new information to me, and I think it's still a pretty new and unstudied field. As Gary says in one of his videos, it's hard to conduct studies because other studies have shown that basically all young men in the Western world use internet porn on a regular basis, and therefore you don't have a control group. But this is beginning to change as a growing number of young guys is now giving up porn. It's a very interesting phenomenon, I think. It's okay to read my email on the air. Have a very nice day now. You will always have a place on my couch if you ever visit Sweden." And that's from David. Well, David, I think it was very courageous of you to be as candid as you have been and also to give me approval to read this on air. At first, I was a little bit resistant to the idea because of my long list of guests that I'm trying to get to, but this sounds like a pretty unique and fascinating topic, and particularly the possibility of the neuroscience tie-in. So this is going to go pretty high on my list of planned guests. And I would be interested to hear from others out there your response to what David has written here. If anybody is having similar experiences or suspecting similar things for themselves, let me know. Gary Wilson has a big presence on the internet, on the web, and I was able to find him, and it is Gary Wilson, and he's got a website, and he does have videos and lots of material on his blog, so listeners can check him out. I intend to try to bring him in as a guest. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone, my message phone, 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Robert A. Moss, for sharing his very provocative biopsychological therapy model. And by the way, you'll find a link to his book, For Better or For Worse, Am I in Love with a Giver or a Taker? And that's $16.95 US book is advertised in the right-hand sidebar on our site. So take a look at it there. Click on it. It will take you to his website where you can find out a little bit more. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. John Amadeo, psychotherapist, international lecturer, and author of the new book, Dancing with Fire, A Mindful Way to Loving Relationships. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.